Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. On today's episode, I'm joined by Peter Leo, who is a coach for Team Jaco Alula, a UCI World Tour team, and also a sports scientist. Peter, we last chatted in January of 2022, so it's been a little while. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks for being back on the podcast again. It's been a while, but yeah, great to be back, and hopefully we got some interesting topics to chat.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're set for a very good discussion. For listeners that don't know you, can you give a quick 1 minute introduction to yourself to set the stage for our discussion?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm Peter Leo. I'm from Austria, not Australia. I work for Australia. And yeah, I have a sports science background, but I'm really working more towards, high performance coaching at the moment in both cycling and triathlon.
What can you elaborate on your roles in triathlon? Because that's not something that I mentioned in my intro.
Yeah, triathlon has always been like my passion, given my personal background. And yeah, from like, there was actually a really close friend of mine who was looking for a coach. And yeah, we actually teamed up. He's an Austrian triathlete, 2024 Olympian. And so we started the little project. And I always find, if I want to be doing something, I want to go back to triathlon. And really also, I think triathlon is the most challenging sport as a high performance coach to coach, because you have three disciplines and you got to just coaching cyclists or runners is relatively easier than triathletes. So, and I thought it's a great challenge for myself to advance my knowledge and also my coaching practices.
Yeah. And how long have you been with Team Jaco Alula?
4 years.
Okay. And yes. What specifically is your role there?
I'm a sports scientist and coach there. And I'm also and that's in conjunction with the endurance training scientist role for Cycling Australia as well.
Got it. All right. Well, since we have talked before on the podcast, and listeners can go and have a listen to that, I'll link it in the show notes. I want to ask you to start with, what is one thing that you've changed your mind about when it comes to training and performance since that previous interview?
I think looking back in 2021, I just finished my research and was at that time almost like a full academic. I still was working in the under 23 cycling development area more. I had this, especially with the Austrian team there, where I coached, nowadays almost World Tour pros, and some of them are pretty successful. I think the most interesting project for me long term or looking back was definitely Florian Lipowitz, getting him from biathlon into cycling and do that project alongside Dan Lorang was very, very insightful and learned a lot through that. But Lipowitz was not the only one. I think there was other good couple of examples. But I think, yes, through the whole maturation of being a coach and going through the up and downs, it's not only ups, it's actually more downs on the way. You got a lot more humble in what you know and what you actually don't know. And I think just, be almost a lot more reflective on best practice. And I know it sounds a bit of a dogma, but just keep things simple and try to do the simple stuff extremely well. I think that's really like nailing the basics. I think that's a really powerful concept. And I'm not the only one who appraises that, but I think it's a lot of other coaches I think would probably agree.
So what is something specific that you simplified, maybe something you stopped doing since then?
I test a lot less. I love the testing, obviously coming from a sports science background and being in the lab a lot of time, and obviously also doing research in this area, I got a bit tired of testing. And I also think in very often the testing did not necessarily explain the performance improvements or even decrements we saw in the field. And that's why I think I definitely test a lot less and try to use more training sessions, but also just racing information to make the picture a bit, to add more context. So I would say testing is definitely something I almost, with an athlete I really know, I hardly do any testing anymore, and I'm not a big fan of testing general.
That's really interesting, and makes a lot of sense, especially with pro athletes. I think that in general they don't tend to like testing, probably because it's, I guess, to a certain extent, the fitter you are, the harder it is to do a maximal test. And also when you have cyclists that race so much anyway, they're doing a lot of maximal efforts. You only have so many bullets, even mentally, to go to the well. So you maybe want to save them for race day rather than for testing sessions.
No, absolutely. I think that's exactly what you learn when you work a lot with elite athletes, that, you know, the time you actually can make an impact in training and in preparation is really, really rare because of very busy racing schedules and yeah, just in general, a very busy time being a professional athlete. But that's also really for short distance triathlon. You got less racing there, but also the time there, the ability to prepare is also really rare, and you got to budget the time and allocate the time really wisely. And so I think just the testing doesn't really add a lot of context, especially in these highly trained, unless there is like a really specific question you want to answer. Like, for example, if you think about triathlon, getting a better understanding of fuel utilization or efficiency testing, or in a World Tour Pro, just looking for like when there is an underperformance, you obviously do your due diligence and work through the required steps, but that's then also very often, you know, from the medical team mediated, and it's more like other relevant topics like athletes' health and so on. So I think it has definitely a place, monitoring and assessment in a very standard way. But just when it comes down to coaching practice and day-to-day training, I rather prefer having a good set of training and some, I call them, honest sessions, which add a lot of more value to the athlete and also, in my opinion, a lot of a better quality.
Yeah. One topic that you've researched that I wanted to touch on or talk about in some detail, more from a practical perspective, is cadence. So your research has been on the torque cadence and power cadence relationship in elite cyclists. But in practical terms, how do you use different cadences in training?
I think the topic was, or why I got interested in this topic was through the track and with the Australian team and their track focus, especially in team pursuit. You got to get exposed to the question around gear optimization and kind of what cadence are they able to produce which power, and also just look, better understand what is the limiting factor for them. And also, like, if you work with track sprinters and just, yeah, understanding the concept of the torque cadence relationship and also the cadence power relationship, that's quite key in order to understand the mechanistic components of those performances. And I was wondering why, you know, like certain athletes can only operate at certain cadences. And so I was actually investigating it from like a bit of a research project and looking for a set of tests. What we did, like a maximum cadence, we assessed the maximum cadence and maximum torque through a set of sprints. And then we did a really gear restricted test where they had to really perform a maximum effort or multiple maximum efforts at gear restricted ratios. And so what we actually found is that, you know, in the short duration exercise, less than 2 minutes, like you really peripherally limited, like it's just something that the muscle can no longer really hold up, and so you really kind of torque limited over there. But as soon as you get in that so-called severe intensity domain, where in theory you can attain your VO2 max just from an exercise physiology point of view, it becomes more like a central limitation rather a peripheral limitation, because what the body or the athlete tries to do is to optimize the torque load by adjusting the cadence. They actually want to keep the torque load quite constant. And so we did a series of testing, like critical power testing in the field. Again, here we tested a lot, but that was for a research project. And we looked between the fresh and the fatigue power profile. And we were also looking at the cadences, and the torque demand hardly made a difference between fresh and fatigued, but you could see that the drop in cadence was more evident when they fatigued. So actually, you actually fatigue through crank turns, and that's also the proven concept from sprint cycling, you know, where you actually fatigue per crank turns rather than the torque load per se.
When you say that you fatigue through crank turns, can you elaborate on that? What exactly do you mean?
Yeah, so if you go for a maximum sprint, every additional pedal revolution you take, you just carry fatigue around you. So it's and that's quite an important concept. That's obviously through maximum sprint exercise, but even for sub-maximal exercise, you can always say that the accumulation of crank turns adds fatigue, because every crank turn you have a certain torque load, you have a certain power demand and energetic demand, and that's why when you reduce the cadence to 60 RPM, you measure the best efficiency. Because and that's proven for a very, very long time that low cadence actually, in terms of VO2 uptake, is actually ending in the lowest VO2 recordings compared to 90 or even 100 RPM. The problem is, if you have that low cadences, is that proportionally for the same power, the torque has to go up, just because of the relation to torque cadence dictates literally power production. So power is the product of torque and cadence. And I think that's from a practical point of view as a coach, if you understand better both streams, like the torque demand from a force perspective and the cadence demand more from a velocity perspective, you can marry both elements into maximizing or optimizing power output production, depending on what you train for. And I think that was a quite powerful learning as a coach, where you then, from a training perspective, can actually add some really good variation to it.
Before digging into the training, then, what does that have any implications for racing? Because if we know now that in the extreme domain, 2 minutes and shorter, you're limited by your torque, but then as the duration goes out, it becomes longer, you're limited more by your cadence and you accumulate fatigue through crank turns, that seems to then point towards, well, just pedal at a lower cadence when you're racing for 30 minutes, for 1 hour, for 4 hours. Is that how you would look at it?
Yeah.
Obviously, then in triathlon, we can also discuss what is the impact on the run.
No, exactly right. I think that goes into that direction. So I think just in terms of the terminology, you have actually quite three important terms which are involved around the cadence topic. First of all, it's your maximum cadence, which is ideally assessed through a sprint, or there's also like the spin bike, where you literally have no resistance and you pedal as hard as you can or as fast as you can for 6 seconds, and then you literally assess your Cmax. So the short term is Cmax, maximum, referred to maximum cadence, and that's primarily really dictated by your muscle fiber typology. Like track sprinters probably reach Cmaxes of 270-280 RPM, whereas BMX riders have even 300 plus RPM, and then like the track endurance athletes are between 230 and 250 RPM, and then maybe road sprinters around 220-230, and then more the endurance guys or even triathletes probably around 160-180, but not higher, because it's just a recruitment thing. And it's also really hard to train that, because it's really dictated by your muscle fiber typology, and that actually is an indirect test of your fiber typology, or kind of where you're coming from, the fast twitch end or more from the slow twitch end, which is obviously not so hard to assess. So that's your Cmax. And on the halfway, let's say your Cmax is 200, just to get a ballpark, then your optimum cadence, where you actually can expose your best sprint peak power just because of the cadence torque relationship, is 100 RPM. So that's exactly halfway. So your optimum cadence is referred to 50% of your Cmax. And that's where normally in the torque cadence relationship, the torque load is optimized to a certain pedal revolution, where that results in the maximum peak power output, which is literally the maximum of the parabolic power cadence shape, if you remember that relationship. So that's quite important, and that's the lessons from sprint cycling. And when you go more to the left side, where the torque demand is higher, then you obviously add more force to or torque to a training, whereas you go more on the right side to the cadence spec, to the maximum cadence spectrum, you obviously add a lot more velocity versus frequency to your training. So I think that's a really important underlying concept of understanding it. But then there's the so-called preferred cadence, which is an athlete that, you know, that's obviously more applicable for road cyclists, because they train a lot outdoors when they do efforts, and and the preferred cadence is really, really, if athletes don't focus on training at a big cadence variation, that's a really narrow range. And what you can observe then is that if athletes go beyond or below it, you could see that the power output production really declines rapidly, because it's just they're not used to it. And everyone can probably mirror that from a performance test in the lab, where a sudden drop in cadence results in an immediate loss in power output just because of the relationship to it. So what you try to achieve here with the learnings, what we got through this project, is that you actually want to expand your power delivery through a broader cadence range. And that's why the powerful thing, adding lower RPMs versus high RPMs, should be able to elevate your cadence spectrum for better power production. And that has a really important implication, for example, in the classics, where you are forced sometimes to accelerate out of a corner or in a gradient where you cannot be at your preferred cadence, but you still got to be able to produce the power to be able to hold the wheel. Same for triathlon or same for road cycling. So I think there is a lot of practical examples where this could be really valuable. It's just important that there is an awareness that that can actually be trained.
What about something that is very steady state, like an Ironman or any long distance triathlon, especially on the amateur side, where you're not really involved in race dynamics, you're just focusing on your own pacing and doing an even time trial over several hours? Is it still important or somewhat important? What would you say? Thank you to Precision Full Hydration for sponsoring today's episode. Whether you're training for your first sprint triathlon, a marathon or trail running race, or a full Ironman, they make fueling and hydration practical and personalized. Their PF30 and PF90 gels give you reliable carbohydrate products with a neutral taste that you don't get flavor fatigue from. And the PF30 caffeinated gel can give you that small additional performance kick that you might want at certain strategic points in the race. The Flow gel, on the other hand, is brilliant for holding a big volume of carbs in just one bottle on the bike, but even in a soft flask in longer running events like trail races or on the marathon in an Ironman. For hydration, they have drink mixes, and they have electrolyte tablets and sachets that you can tailor to your sweat sodium concentration. They also offer free video consultations that are available to anybody, regardless of whether you use Precision or not. And this is really an incredible offer. I personally made use of these consultations several times, and the athlete support team that deliver them really, really know their stuff. I've been super impressed every time. Go to precisionfuelhydration.com to book a consultation and use the code TTS2026 at checkout for 15% off your first order.
I think the lower you go in the power demand, like the more steady state you are, the less important is the influence of cadence, because that's what you see in road cycling, you know? Like if athletes like go really steady in the bunch, they go at very low RPMs because they just don't want to waste any kind of additional turnover or energy by just spinning the whole way through. That's no point. But as soon as there is load coming to the pedal, like athletes start to optimize the gear ratio or the cadence, obviously, through shifting or through adaptations in the preferred cadence to actually optimize the torque load. So it really comes in where you go around your threshold power or beyond that. And so I think for Ironman, you're obviously operating around your LT1, which is considered quite low from a whole power demand. However, you got to, as you said previously, you got to have in mind that you still got to be able to run a solid marathon from it. So what a practical recommendation could be that, you know, you try to be efficient as you can in the first half, but towards you come more to the run, you probably lift your cadence by 5 RPM to 10 RPM towards the end to just make sure that you got that turnover already for having the running legs you hope for. Because if you have a very powerful low pedal revolution, that might be really good for your bike, but I'm not sure if that's the best transition for your subsequent run. So I think there are some relevant points to triathlon as well. I think it's actually quite important in short distance triathlon, where you have a lot of acceleration going on out of the corner, out of U-turns. So I think that's a really important thing because it's like crit racing in road cycling. But I think for Ironman, yeah, it really depends on your composition of your bike package and run package.
Yeah. Do you think that pedaling at a slightly lower cadence in a more steady state Ironman, that it affects your run potentially? And if so, why is it? Because the torque demand is relatively low, because the power is relatively low. But is it just the accumulation of torque over time, or?
No, I don't think it. I don't think it impacts it in a negative way. I think it's just more. Let's say you take an Ironman and they were going 75 to 80 RPM for almost 4 hours. I think it just makes more sense from a practical point of view that they try to lift the cadence to around 85, 90 RPM for the last 10K to just get. It's more like a cue thing. It doesn't need to have like a really physiological relevance. But it's, I think it's just more like an awareness thing that athletes are actually lifting up that cadence to actually get that running feel of running or feel of higher a leg turnover into the legs before they start the run. You know.
Yeah. Got it. Well, so for anybody who wants to or who benefits from practicing to expand that range of cadences, how do you implement that in training?
Yeah, so I think I really like to quote Jim Martin here, who has been quite influential into my thinking. He's a professor from the University of Utah, and he always has been part of our discussion, given his long time experience in, you know, working in force velocity based sports, but also track cycling. And he got the concept of work loops, where you actually fatigue by crank turn. And that's because of your ability to activate versus deactivate your muscle motor unit. And so that pattern looks very different if you go 60 RPM, which equals to 1 hertz, versus 90 RPM, which is 1.5 hertz, versus 120 RPM, which is 2 hertz. Because the higher the hertz, the higher the frequency, the less is the time for the so-called relaxation or the deactivation phase for the motor unit. And that has really a very important implication, because what 60 hertz is doing, or 1 hertz, 60 RPM is doing, is you have enough time for your deactivation, but proportionally your torque demand is higher. And then what you do at 120 hertz, which is double of your cycle time, is that actually the torque load can't be high, because you just go at a higher angle of velocity. But what happens is you have less time for the deactivation. So it's two very different things. One is more like force restrictive, versus one is more velocity restrictive. And adding that in, that both extremes make, initially when an athlete is doing it, makes an athlete feel very uncomfortable, because athletes often think only about power, right? And if I give you, let's say you do 400 watts at 60 RPM versus 400 watts at 120 RPM, is a very, very different sensation. And it doesn't make them feel comfortable, but it's quite a powerful thing. And I have been quoting on a set, which everyone who is interested in the concept should try. You do 3 sets of 30-30s, 10 times, 10 reps. And the first one, you do the on phase, so the 30 seconds on with 60 RPM, and the off phase with 90 RPM. Then you switch around. You do the on phase around 190 to 120 RPM, and the off phase with 60 RPM. And then in the last one, you take the freely chosen cadence, and it's actually quite interesting. It's almost like you unlock a hidden power, because it has some preconditioning from the neuromuscular unit, but also from I think there's some neuromuscular quick learnings to it, not adaptations, but just some interesting two streams. That then if you go into the third set, because you have been working on the really high force side versus high velocity side, all of a sudden the body just finds another gear. And for me, that was a quite powerful practical session, which is, it's really good for mixing up training. But I'm not saying that has to be every session, but if you have time in the preparation, it's always worthwhile adding a bit of a variation. So I found it really helpful in the preparation of the athletes I work with.
Would you introduce similar cadence variations in other harder sessions for your cyclists? So this is one example, but then if an athlete does some kind of threshold session, sometimes you would introduce cadence variations in that session as well? Or is it only specific sessions where you do these cadence variations?
It's pretty specific sessions. I think you should never underestimate the impact of preferred cadence. So they still need to be able to optimize their, find their preferred cadence, especially the closer you go to competition. I think that that's kind of really important that they also get the confidence back into kind of their patterns, their pedal patterns. But I think if you got time, let's say a 3-week block where you can add 1 to 2 times a week those cadence manipulations in your sessions, I think that's really, really helpful.
And do you ever introduce cadence variations in more of an endurance type of ride, or is it only in these harder, higher intensity work?
I like to, for example, if you take the concept of the 30-second sprints, you know, which Nick Almquist and colleagues proposed in an endurance ride, which does not actually impact the outcomes for the endurance part. I really like to do this as rolling accelerations where they start from a really, really big gear, 30, 40 RPMs, or almost like a standing start in the biggest gear they can get, slightly uphill, and actually try to get a maximum acceleration out over that 30 seconds. And they're quite gear restricted, so they never really reach the full sprint peak power, but it's a really, really powerful tool to develop that pattern.
Right, yeah. And final question on this then, is this something that you would work on in more specific blocks, like 3-4 weeks, or would you try to every week get in something that has to do with working on different cadences?
I think it has its place in like a really good preparation block, whereas if you go in between races, it's probably a bit an overstimulation. But I think if you have like 3 weeks time, why not adding that type of work? And it's also really, really powerful for time trialing, especially in position and in the bars. And yeah, a coach, very, very, very successful coach in Australia, Tim Decker, who was the national track coach for the last 10 years. We had a lot of discussion about this, and what he said is like, it's really important in this team pursuit type of effort, but even road time trials, is the ability of that seated torque. And what he meant by seated torque is you go in your bars and you really stay in your bars and you do the effort and you really have to activate all the glute and hamstring activation through a very, very powerful pedal stroke. And that's something we found super, super valuable. Despite they were not hitting the best power numbers in those sessions, they had a very, very strong translation in power production into more specific workouts later from that kind of base work.
Yeah, that's actually, so I take back my statement about it being the last question about cadence, because this low cadence example, that's something to dig into a bit more, I think, because we have been talking about that expanding that range of the preferred cadence. But then, yeah, low cadence training is also quite important, popular and potentially important in cycling and in triathlon. And so, but also some of the reasons stated for using low cadence are very different from that expanding the preferred cadence range. It's things like activating muscle fibers of different types and training them more in an oxidative way, the slightly faster or hybrid type muscle fibers and that sort of thing. There are a few different theories, I think, and I guess we don't really know, but do you think that is something that, regardless of whether it expands your cadence range, are there other reasons to, or is torque training from that perspective that is traditionally done now in, or has been done for a while in triathlon with 4-minute, 8-minute reps at low cadence, high torque, is that something that is beneficial irrespective of whether it expands your preferred cadence and whether you're training for something like an Ironman?
Yeah, I think when you really come down to kind of this kind of torque demand, because when you lower the cadence, you want to actually work on the torque side and just work on that, really. Like it's also referred to strength, which is a bit misleading in an endurance context, because if you look at it from pure strength perspective, it has nothing to do with strength per se, but just from a cue, like they call the topic of strength. I think what you definitely want to do is, if you really have, if you, let's say around LT1, The only thing why adding cadence variation or low cadence training to throw in is variation. You know, there is not a really strong effect on anything unless previously stated with the cross efficiency. You have obviously better cross efficiency with lower cadences just because of lower VO2 uptake. So that has a place even in submaximal exercise, and that's something for sure you want to explore in triathlon, but also let's say in rolling stages of a grand tour where athletes are also comfortable with going at 75-80 RPM just because they also want to save energy turnover through an unnecessary need of VO2 expression. So that there has its place. I think the more interesting thing when you really want to come from the torque side is really work from your FTP or critical power upwards. Mm-hmm. So it's more like really the work dedicated around your heavy, upper heavy into your severe domain. Because this is where, you know, peripheral fatigue versus central fatigue are really, really kind of occurring. And I think that's where this concept is really interesting. And actually also what you said, adding fatigue resistance to type 2 fibers, etc., and trying to achieve those adaptations there with the use of low RPM, I would just not go too long in terms of the efforts. I think everything between 2 to 5 minutes is a really good ballpark. I think longer than that, you just have then the cost that you cannot maintain the power demand, so you have to lower the power demand. But it comes also down with how experienced the athlete is, because I think it's better if an athlete has never underwent then, and then you go straight to a very high power demand. What happens when you're not well prepared is that if you increase torque load too fast or power demand too fast, athletes become issues in terms of knee issues, or in general just tightness or hamstring issues. So you want to definitely avoid that. So you got to really, really match that torque loading in terms of Newton meters per kilogram of body mass, or you can also just plot power versus cadence over the time, but make sure that you really, really progress the torque loading throughout the weeks just to give the athlete the ability to cope with that new stimulus.
Yeah. Okay, excellent points. Let's shift gears a bit to a few different topics. I wanted to ask you, going back to very much basics, about some key training principles, starting with individualization, which I guess I'll ask the question in a bit of a provocative way to get an interesting discussion. How much does individualization actually matter when you're programming for a homogenous group of athletes?
I would say, again, a scientific compromise. It depends. Now, I'm kidding. I think you got to really look at it through the different phases in your preparation. I think if coming from off season in going into the December camp, as they always do in road cycling, there is not a really high level of specificity required because they just get back on the bike. They just got to accumulate some training volume. And yes, there might be some specifics of sprinters maybe start with some acceleration and some, as we said, some low gear, high torque work, versus climbers might go into more like the climbing terrain. So obviously you have those specifications of the sub rider types, but I think you should not reinvent the wheel and think like, oh, it has to be like super individualized in that blocks, because it's just more about getting the load right, building them up, staying healthy. And the more you shift into more specific preparation or pre-competition, then obviously individualization and working on your strength weaknesses is really important, you know, because then you have riders who struggle more on the long power demand, some on the short power demand, some have issues with the spiked pattern of efforts, some struggle with acceleration, some need to dedicate more time into time trial work. And then obviously one size fits all doesn't fit. So I think the individualization comes in really as you move towards the season. And then obviously also between races, like you only got 10 days of training available. What do you do? And obviously you got to be hitting the nail there with your sessions, because you don't have much time to get them ready for the next race. So I think it's really like a pattern throughout the season where you start more generalized and you know, just get them fit, get them used back to really high training volumes. And then when you go more into the specific preparation into the first races and then between races, then actually the individualization starts.
Yeah, that's a great answer. What about, I mean, you could say that load needs to be individualized. What's your take on that? Like, is there a large difference in your cohort of athletes, in professional cyclists, in how much load they do or that they can do?
Oh, yes, 100%. I think, you can look at more from an internal versus external load perspective, which I think is a really important concept to understand anyway, because, you know, external load from a stage race, it's 100K for everyone. It's 4,000 meters of climbing for everyone. It's 5 days for everyone. So you won't be able to change that. That load pattern stays the same for everyone. The other side is how you digest this or how do you absorb that load. That's the crux. And that, you know, this is actually quite multifactorial. Like, you got a huge proportion of how you recover, and that is nutritional related. Like, how do you periodize nutrition and your post, pre and during race competition, race nutrition a package. So I think that's really, really important, very often underrated. I think professional teams obviously get that right. But also, like, there's really, really big between rider differences in kind of what they are able to absorb, while they can still be able to perform well. So I think that's a really important part from tolerating load. And the other one is just chronic training exposure. You know, it just takes time to be able to absorb load. And we see young athletes who going into the World Tour now, which almost seem tolerating the load faster than everyone else. It's just also that, you know, the under 23 racing got a lot more aggressive and the junior racing got a lot more aggressive. And so we see a bit of a changing pattern in how much time you have in your pathway or in your development of getting ready to absorb the load. Because in the race, it's there. It's just the question is, how do you get from A to B in almost a very short period of time? However, I still think it's important to go back and say, look at your athlete, look what they have been training and where are the progressions happening? Because if you do it too fast, athlete is not responding. If you do it too slow, then you have the problem that they cannot tolerate the race load. So it's really that balance. And then again, individualization comes in because not everyone responds in the same way to the same, 200K, 4,000 meters of climbing, whatever. So that's kind of the puzzle we try to solve day in, day out.
For amateur athletes, if you take two amateur athletes, triathletes performing at a similar level, like they're solid amateur triathletes, then what are the factors that you think are the biggest drivers of different individualization needs for the two of them?
100% recovery. 100% recovery.
That's what I thought that you'd say.
Yeah, 100% recovery. Yeah. I think that's not only for age groupers, but in general, I think the difference is not like nowadays everyone trains a lot, you know, and everyone actually is able to go out and it's not that people trying to hide the work or don't want to do the work, but it's literally where you see the big difference is how do they recover from the big work days. And this is just the massive differences we see. Something is better explained by training adaptation. Some is actually less explained. You sometimes just don't have an answer why athlete A is responding better than athlete B. So it's a never ending question. But I think when you look for an easy answer, it's definitely optimizing your recovery. And that's a very, very broad topic because also there's not the perfect recovery strategy. Like, recovery is so, again, multifactorial. It has a sleep component, it has a nutritional component, but it also has a really important psychological component as well. Like, you can be nailing your sleep well and your nutrition well, but if you're not in the right social environment, like if you miss seeing your family or your friends or you're just not happy with your team or with the people around you, that has a really detrimental effect to your recovery and then subsequent to your performance. So I think this is also really what needs to be managed and taken into account when looking into training adaptation and performance stability.
Yeah. All right. You mentioned specificity already and how individualization becomes especially important there. Do you think, and I'm asking this more from a perspective of what I see amateur triathletes doing rather than what you do with your World Tour cyclists, But do you think that race specificity is overemphasized in training at the expense of doing the most you can to maximize your general physiological capacities?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions. And, you know, that's the same for road cycling. Like, or you can take and say, look, this is required in the race. That's how we need to train. Well, this is probably not the right thing to do because a race scenario is quite complex. It's complex in road cycling, but it's also complex in triathlon because you've got three different disciplines. You got different, you know, bike demands from course profiles. You got different run demands. So it's you got either open water swims in the lake or in a sea. So that's kind of really, really big, very different race demands. So you cannot unify them, and that's exactly how we need to train. I think what's important to know where the sport is training, like what are the required times in the run, in the swim, in what are the required speeds or watts or in general, just the determinants of the sport. Well, that's not a rocket science, but understanding the trend and where the athlete is tracking is really important as a coach, because this is literally your framework on how you emphasize on kind of the session outline. For example, take an Olympic distance triathlete with a really good swim bike package, but he really cannot nail the run. Then you actually need to know, how do I get him to this top 15, top 20, or even top 10 runner in the world triathlon? Well, then you actually need to know what are the average top 10 running times over a season in a world triathlon race, for example. And then you got to look at this target and actually try to replicate sessions that mimic that target. But that doesn't always mean each session needs to be around the race speed or race target. So I think it's a balance between knowing what's going on, knowing where the athlete needs to develop in order to bridge that gap, but at the same time, acknowledging training principles and acknowledging in terms of recovery, in terms of loading patterns, in terms of training intensity distribution. So again, it's a puzzle where I think coaching experience plays a really important role, because if I take my journey from a very young, hopefully I'm still considered young, but from a, let's say, a less experienced coach to a bit more experienced coach I'm now, is that, you know, 5-8 years ago, I always try to achieve most of the things at the same time. Whereas now I just go more like, okay, we got a block here, and I'm thinking more in terms of blocks. I said, well, this is our endurance block. That can even be considered in a week. You got your endurance block, you got your speed block, you got your strength block, and then you got your threshold or power block. And I feel like if you cluster those emphasis a bit better, which doesn't mean a strength block, every session has to be strength, but that's just the emphasis of that block or that microcycle. And you still have sessions that allow athletes to recover, like an easy swim, an easy run in between. You cannot have a strength day, let's call it, and all three sessions in all three disciplines will be strength. Maybe two of them can be strength and one has to be easy. But clustering those training aims in a microcycle or in a mesocycle, I think is really valuable to also direct the right training adaptation.
Yeah. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. One anecdote that I think is really interesting is Christian Blumenfeld in the summer of 2024 after the Paris Olympics, so training for the Olympics. Obviously didn't have the Olympics that he wanted, but clearly got himself into some good fitness nevertheless, and then some weeks later goes and does Ironman Frankfurt on very limited specific training and does an amazing, wins the race, 2:32 marathon, I think, with some problems along the way. So one of the fastest marathons at that time over the distance. And to me, that was just an example of, well, if you're doing the load anyway, he's doing the load anyway, regardless of which distance he's training for. So then the specific intensities matter much less than did he get is his endurance, his durability good enough? Is his threshold good enough? And somebody can focus completely on, let's say, doing a 3-hour marathon for the Ironman. But if you can barely break 40 minutes for an open 10K, then your limitation isn't your ability to do longer and longer sessions on the Ironman. It's So that's a bit where I'm getting at. And I think that maybe that's something that I see in the zeitgeist of training, a little bit too much focus on specificity, but maybe more from an amateur perspective for sure, not so much in terms of the professionals.
Yeah, because I think in the amateurs, it's very often about, you know, team being time crunched and making the most out of sessions. But that doesn't always mean you need to be mimicking your race demands.
Yeah.
But yeah, I 100% agree to that. And having actually a clearer understanding of what gets me to the running a 3-hour marathon, and that, you know, that's very strongly determined by the ability of your 10K and even your half marathon. So it might be easier wins to look at this first and actually try to establish that base. And then you, with the right running mileage a week, then it's probably, this is where the biggest shift happened towards a really good, solid marathon performance.
Yeah. And I guess, do you think, how does the need for specificity vary based on what sort of race you're training for? So take two examples, take an Olympic distance, draft legal triathlon versus an Ironman. Would you consider different durations of really specific training for those two races, or how would you think about that?
I think if you take it from a general preparation, probably very, very similar. And I've a pretty good example of the short distance triathlete I work with is a really good training buddy from a middle distance, long distance, German middle distance and long distance triathlete, like Jeppe Kindle and Frederik Frunk. And they train the general preparation almost really a lot together. You know, there's very little differences we make because I know they benefit from each other and they also like the company. But then obviously when it goes more to specific preparation, they can still go in the same training camp. But then, you know, the short distance triathlete just emphasizes more on his quality runs, whereas the long distance triathlete goes more into his long runs. So it's just that, but they still will be doing same sessions, similar sessions. But then there's one or two sessions in the week where they just go, the other has to go longer and the other has to go faster. That's just what they are preparing for. But again, I think 90% of the training is not rocket science. You know, it's just the 10% of extra specificity what comes to the sport. But at the end of the day, it's still an endurance sport. And if you just look at the training volumes, short distance, the top short distance athletes are training, it's actually not a lot less than Ironman athletes from a training load. To that training load, however, there is actually a lot more intensity proportional to Ironman distance triathletes. And that's also what we see at the moment, why then the transition actually is relatively easy for really, really solid short distance triathletes to transition. I mean, the transition to middle distance is almost like it's just a long day out for them. And then Ironman is obviously, there is the whole component of nutrition and so on. And not everyone from the short distance can seamlessly transition to the long distance, but you see the frequency definitely went up in the last couple of years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's also, if you exclude, let's say, the top 30 to 50 athletes, men and women in the Ironman, or even, yeah, top 30 maybe, where they really have enough resources to be fully, fully professional, then I think often the short distance athletes train more than the full distance athletes just because they have more support. They might not make a lot of money necessarily, but they have federation camps and they get things sorted for them. They have medical support, physiotherapy support, that sort of thing that makes it easier to train more. And they have a stipend, so they maybe don't need to have a part-time job on the side as much as the long distance athletes. So I think that is a very accurate statement when you say that they don't train much less. And maybe there's a slight difference at the very top of the Ironman pyramid where the top athletes do train a bit more. But yeah, it's high volume at the short distance. I guess one follow-up still, though, is do you think how long would your short distance athlete train? What would the specific preparation for him, how long would that be? And if he wanted to do an Ironman race, how long would the specific preparation be for that race?
I think just a short distance triathlete out of the blue doing an Ironman distance triathlon where the short distance is still the focus, I would not recommend that. And I know there are examples, but I think that's just that's a stretch too much. I think what we generally do is a short distance triathlete who has enough time wants to do a half Ironman. And that's, I think, a really, really good example of how you can incorporate that into a specific preparation. And I think we're talking about a time frame of 4 to 6 weeks here, where actually these specific shifts can be made, because at the end of the day, it's just spending more time on the turntail bike, getting that specific longer efforts, longer intervals between 10 to 20 minutes in, getting a long run in around 20-25k. I think that's probably the longest I let them run. Never do half distance trials longer than 25k in a single run. And then just adding, adding that balance between those key sessions and then just general good training quality.
Yeah. Let's move on to one more training principle, progression. What does effective training progression look like for you?
Knowing where to start with an athlete, I think, is pretty key. Knowing what they did in the past and not trying to make those jumps too aggressively. I think it's coming from swimming or road cycling. I think those progressions can easily be overlooked because it's just you don't have that impact of gravity on your body. Whereas, for example, in running, it's really, really key to nail those progressions well and don't overdo them. I think there has been a really, really good investigation from the British Journal of Sports Medicine on a very, very big cohort of amateur runners. And what they found is if you increase your mileage higher than 10%, your injury hazard massively is increased. So that means if you're running 60 kilometers per week average, going beyond 6 kilometers of progression from week to week is actually risking your injury or increasing your injury risk actually by far. And that adds up. Like if you go 70, then it's 7K. If you go 80, 80K, 8K, 99K, and then only with 100K average, you can lift weekly average by around 10K. And actually, that's quite a conservative approach, but that's been actually quite a powerful tool for me, at least in the progression, planning running progression, to be a bit on more the conservative side. And I think also the most important thing is, especially in running, don't do the deload too. Like don't, let's say, again, take that 60K a week. Don't do deload weeks where then they run only 20 weeks, because that really, 20K. Because they really struggle to get back on the chronic volume again. If you make those, it's better than to just do less intensity, but still do the recovery week around 40K, you know, and just have that base, solid base in. Because I think if you run consistently at your range where you're actually comfortable and where you also can recover, then it's better to stay in the range rather than having these aggressive jumps to the lower end, but also to the upper end, and just be consistent in your running mileage. That's the best thing in terms of longitudinal development and performance stability, I figured out.
But how long can you keep progressing? Because there's a point of where more is not really more anymore. So
yes.
How do you...
I think it really depends on what kind of athlete you're working with. I found if you have a hybrid athlete who has really, really good speed reserve, they're really, really sensible to increasing running volume too much. So I think I've actually seen quite really, really good running performances of, like, say, in a sprint distance triathlon of 14 minutes 10, or even, close to the 14 minutes, and then almost like a 30-minute flat in the 10K, where they were running 60 to 70K, not more. And they were tolerating that sweet spot really well, and there was no need to further increase the distance, because we're talking about short distance triathlon. And then you have some athletes who just need that kind of chronic volume, and they probably go up to 80, 90, 100K. I have rarely seen examples of and then obviously those are the extremes, who run above 100K a week. In triathlon, there are some for sure. You know, I have heard 120, 130, even up to 160K a week. Some athletes do. I think it's just with the other two disciplines, swimming and running, where they still probably swim 25 to 30K a week and still be on the bike around 400 to 500K a week. Then that's a really, really big load in general. And I think that's something that is very easily overlooked in triathlon about the total accumulation of training load.
How should amateur triathletes think about progression? Because usually they're time crunched, there's a fixed amount of hours. So how do you do progression then? Do you just ramp up the intensity until you can't do it anymore, or how would you approach that?
I think I would say progression is even the wrong word in amateur. It's more about the consistency. And having it being consistent as an amateur athlete means that you can run 3 weeks, 3 times a week, swim 2 to 3 times a week, get on the bike 2 to 3 times a week is already a great deal. And having that ability to consistently do that is great. And I don't even think that then there needs to be a fourth run or fifth run or third, a fourth swim or fifth swim, unless you go into a training camp, which is obviously a different environment. However, I think what could obviously progress in an amateur trial, it could just be the progression of a long run, you know, where you start your long run probably in around 15K, you go to 20K, and then ideally it depends if you're doing half distance triathlon or long course, is you probably end up even at 30, 35K for the longest, you know. So I think specific session definitely should progress, but probably the overall weekly structure should be relatively kept constant just because of all the side commitments they have with work, family. And then we already said previously that the recovery is not impaired too much.
And do you include intensity in that as well? So if an athlete is doing some type of intense session on an intense run on a Tuesday or an intense bike on a Thursday, would you also keep those quite consistent, maybe shift the type of session, but not really try to progress a particular type of session so much?
Yeah, I think I would keep that intensity in, but it's not about maximizing that intensity. I think that's probably key. I think that intensity should just be a bit of a variation to a different stimulus, and also not forget to, you know, to tackle your top end as well, despite you going long. But I think overdoing that, especially overdoing VO2 work in an amateur athlete with a goal of long distance is not what I would recommend. I think there's still a place to do it, don't get me wrong. But I've never seen really good results coming out if you overdo VO2 max training with long distance athletes.
When you say overdo VO2 max training, does that mean doing too many sessions or doing too big sessions, too much intensity within a single session?
Both. I think both. Most start maybe even too early. If you start doing HIIT sessions already in January, whereas you actually performing in June in your first Ironman, that's a very, very long time. And you probably should work through a bit of more like a cluster where you say, look, I can do a VO2 block here or a short set here. And then I go back to more threshold work and stability work, and then I add one. So you probably have that rotation through 3 times until you're Ironman, but don't do it consistently week in, week out, because I think the risk for plateau and stagnation is very high when you do it.
Yeah. Let me see here if there's anything else on this topic. I think that we're good there with the progression. So I have a few other assorted questions, and we won't get to all of them, but let me pick some interesting ones. Okay, I want to ask you, how do you evaluate whether an athlete is responding to training?
That's a really good question. I think it's twofold. It's what I see, what I see on Training Peaks, or what I get back from looking at the powers, the heart rate, but also the RPE. Athletes are rating them. And it probably, if you try, especially what we touched previously, if you add some new training, don't give yourself the time, you as a coach, but also as an athlete, to not say throw it out of the window after the first session didn't go well. Have the confidence that you could just keep trying to work on it for a while, but then obviously also don't be afraid to say, look, doesn't seem to actually benefit you that much than we thought. So also be critical and when not to do it. I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing is really be open in your discussion and conversation to your athlete and how they feel it is going and what they are thinking, because at the end of the day, we're working with humans, and if they don't enjoy what they're doing, we're not doing a great job. So I think it's on two ways. It has an objective criterion, but also obviously they can still hit great powers, but if they just hate the session and just don't get any good thing out of it, then it's also probably worthwhile rethinking if it's really the right thing to do with this athlete.
But is it really about looking at that particular session and how things are going there objectively and subjectively? Or are there things that you can do in terms of the overall or the rest of the athlete's training to assess whether they're responding well. Because I mean, in theory, just to put a hypothetical example, let's say you have somebody that is doing a type of session for a few weeks and it's going really well. They're hitting the targets, they're progressing maybe even a bit, and or they're feeling that it's going well. But then they come to the race and they underperform in the race. So were they responding to training? It might have seemed like they did, but perhaps they didn't really.
That's the classic example with VO2 for long distance athletes, you know? Like they might be hitting all the numbers and even massacre themselves through each session and get great sensations, but then they realized, oh, I dropped all my good efficiency and economy for the longer sustained work just because you go too hard every time. I think that would be quite detrimental, where you just look too isolated on that session and you forgot the overall picture. So I totally agree. I think it needs to be in the context of the overall picture. And that might still be some session which the athletes don't like, but then we see great wins of that session to another session, or just to performance in general. And then it still has its place to be in the program. So I think at the end of the day, it's the context. You got to make sense of it.
Do you have any metrics that you use other than did they hit their power numbers? Was RPE and feeling good? For example, would you look at things like power to heart rate in endurance rides to assess whether an athlete's endurance is improving or that sort of thing?
Yeah, looking at the efficiency factor, I think is interesting, but also I think the efficiency factor has its limitation because it's, again, it's never a perfect trend line. But again, you can see from the off season, if you zoom out for the bigger picture, coming from off season, going into a specific preparation, what you should obviously see is that the heart rate decreases compared to the power. But then again, when you are chronically overloaded in a training camp, then this relationship can be pretty skewed just because of the parasympathetic activity happening when you go through functional overreaching. So I think it has its place, but also it needs to be seen as context. I think from the other monitoring strategies, you end up, I mean, there's so many other tools you could involve, but you end up doing just what is sustainable in the day-to-day practice and also what athletes like to do, you know? And there might be examples of, and I've been doing, I'm actually tracking my resting physiology since 5-6 years, or even I was one of the pilot testers with Marco Altini's app back in 2014 when he developed it, and I'm still doing it. So I enjoy it, but it's just some athletes who don't like to track resting physiology. And although you find personally value in doing that, you can't force an athlete to do it when they don't feel it's adding a benefit. So that's another example, you know. But then you have athletes who just like the numbers and like crunching it and like looking at their sleep stats. And why do you prevent it then? Especially when they feel it like it informs their habits and their day-to-day practice. So you got to make some compromise there on the journey with your athletes and who likes to do what. But it's never, I would never force someone and say, well, we really need to track resting physiology because it just doesn't add any benefit for them then.
And if an athlete is not responding well to training, and this might not be just a session, but maybe in general, they're not feeling that things are going so well, how do you figure out the reason for why things are not going right?
Well, sometimes you got to just call it and say, well, put it up there and say, well, I am actually the right coach to work with them. And I had experiences where I just had to probably accept and also step back and say, look, I actually don't think I can. With my methodology and with my ability to kind of try to work with this athlete, it doesn't fit. And I think it's also fair to say where you just say, look, we just don't get on. And that happens, you know, that happens where you just struggle with either a personality or just different views. Yeah. And then it's also okay to say, look, it's for you, it's probably better to look into working with another coach where you feel a bit better, or even myself also to protect yourself and say like, oh, I'm actually not really getting on with this athlete or I feel there is no progression. And then it can also be becoming quite frustrating as a coach to work with, and sometimes just recommending and say, look, we got to here, we tried it. No hard feelings, but you know, maybe you're better with finding your luck somewhere else and finding a better coach athlete relationship for you might benefit your goals and ambitions. And I think that's also fair to say, you know.
But I'm guessing it's not the first thing you do if you have, you know, 1 or 2 weeks of the athlete not feeling good. You're trying to figure things out probably before it gets to that point.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. No, so how, that was an so acceleration. I think, yeah, it's just being open and listening to, having the ability to listen to the athlete, what they tell you. And then obviously, some of them are quite mature as well. You know, they might have some really valuable suggestions to tweak the session to that it might be a bit better, a better experience, and be open to that kind of feedback and don't hesitate to adjust something or even try it and do it their way, what they think could add. But I think having that open dialogue to them helps a lot, hopefully, that you don't have to go into that example what I suggested beforehand.
Yeah. I think how, if you would classify three different potential reasons for not responding, one being insufficient stimulus, the other being insufficient recovery, and the third being that it's just a tweak of the stimulus that's needed, that maybe a different type of session or even just slightly changing the details of the sessions that they're doing. How often do you think each of those, or how normal do you think each of those are in the elite athlete cohort that you're working with? And then maybe we can also discuss amateur athletes.
I think in the elite cohort, you actually don't have many variation in terms of the training you do. I think when I realized, or I've looked back and look at what the athlete did, and sometimes you just wonder why is he going so well in this race now? And you look back and you just find look, we have actually been just being consistent. We have our four or five key sessions which we keep doing, and there's actually surprisingly very, very little variation you find yourself, you know? Like some variation I alluded to, like you can always add a bit of cadence work, you can add some little tweaks, but essentially, like you got your block of your tool work, the athlete is comfortable to work with, you got your block of over-under and threshold work, your quality zone two work and tempo work, and that's pretty much the whole package, you know? And I think it's more about being able to stratify that for each athlete or each athlete you work with. And I think that's where the coach-athlete relationship comes in over the years, because, you know, when you're part of the journey over years, you actually know what works and what doesn't. It's more like you really get into this more like experimentation type of thing where you actually don't know the athlete that well. So you just took over an athlete or an athlete joined you. And it's more like being also aware that, and mention it's like, look, the first 6 months will be a bit more explorative. We try to look at different things and where you respond versus where you don't respond. And we keep tracking your sensation and the session metrics. And then you ideally should build this kind of package and R&D for this athlete that helps him perform better in the future. That's how I do it.
Yeah. More on a general, looking at the whole, at endurance sports and what's currently being done in the field, current best practices. What aspects of best practices at the moment do you think are likely to not be the same 5 or 10 years from now?
That's a really good question. That's a hard one.
Because if we would know it, then we might not be doing it, or we probably wouldn't be doing it. So yeah, it's very hard.
I mean, it's a bit of the elephant in the room. It has a place for 30 years, but given the trends now, we see through heat training versus altitude training, maybe it asks the question, is altitude training still beneficial, or should we just carry on with heat only? Or yeah, I think that could be the only thing, is if actually altitude training is still necessary. I think it always is a burden, just financially, logistically, just to always get it organized. And if especially, as you mentioned, time-crunched athletes or athletes who don't have the budget to afford to go up there and live there for almost a month, you know, if there is something that can actually be replaced, maybe that's something we learned, because maybe even 6 years ago, when, you know, the first better studies come out with heat training, although it's not a new thing, but it's just more better investigated, same as, remember, back in 2020 when only a few research groups looked at durability more from cycling. Now you see the whole thing coming also in running, and it's like this whole momentum. It could really change a bit the topic and our understanding, but it would obviously not reinvent training.
Mm. That's super interesting, because when you started talking about heat training, I thought that you were going to say that maybe heat training will be less important, not for performing in hot races, but just potentially, like I feel that maybe heat training is on a bit of a peak on the hype curve now, and potentially it could come down a little bit big, at least from the general performance improvements, not the specific improvements for performing in hot conditions. So it's super interesting that you actually think that, well, it might be a bigger part, and altitude training might be the part that gets pushed to the side, because yeah, it has disadvantages clearly.
I think yeah it's an interesting one. I think yeah, exactly, you just came a bit from the other side, but I think with altitude training, I think it's just in general a lot more enjoyable than the heat. Like the heat is just, if you have done, I've exposed myself to passive and active heat session over blocks, and it's just not like, it's, you got a certain accumulation of where you can tolerate it, and then it just becomes a very, very hard, demanding task, and which, you know, which can also end up in kind of plateauing and as you said, and or even performance stagnation. I think if it's managed well, it's really a powerful tool. I think on the other hand, as with everything, and remember, maybe 10 years ago, we had this hype about high intensity training versus, or polarized versus pyramidal training, and it also seems like this hype is slowly diminishing a bit, and it's just a balance. And at the moment, we always go through these hot topics. I think that's also nothing bad. And that's why, you know, the coaches who are longer in the business, 30 years plus, they have it all seen come and go, and then come again with different names or a different typology. So I think just also don't think that that's the only holy grail. I think it's also important to just emphasize enough on the balance of all the training, all the training variations we need and stimulus we need to perform well.
Yeah. And I think that with how I phrased the question with best practices, like, it's not, maybe it's probably unfair to lump in, let's say, fads or hot topics in there, because they're not really necessarily best practices at this point at the highest level. So thinking about, you know, the whole zone two training debate, which has been more on the, I guess, even health and fitness side rather than athlete side of things, and health and fitness influencers are talking a lot about zone two, but I don't think that that's necessarily something that any elite athletes or elite coaches have been going crazy about any more than, or using it any more in recent years than 5 or 10 years ago. So the fads are maybe more something that is seen on social media and maybe trickles down a bit into some athletes, but more so on the amateur side than the, probably.
Yeah, that's why I don't go on an influencer podcast. Yeah. I go to Scientific Triathlon, because we can keep with the facts here and the evidence. And yeah, apparently that's a bit of a concern, I think, from a high performance point of view, that, you know, you have so many opinionated people out there who don't have that background and their experience, but are actually quite confident in what they're talking about. And it's it always reminds me a bit of the Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, where they don't often realize the peak of Mount Stupidity.
Yeah. Let's do two more questions. So the next one is, how do you see AI realistically influencing endurance coaching?
I think influence is a good word. I think it will never will overtake coaching. I think because it's just with the personal component between a coach and athlete, it will never be able to replace that. However, I think it will have a place in terms of technology to just help a coach to better work through this whole accumulation of data. You know, we gather so much data and be able to almost literally, can you just plot the training intensity distribution of this last 6 to 8 weeks with an emphasis on the run? And then basically this AI can do that without you going into doing all the steps required, downloading the data, doing your own charts, maybe write your own code to see what you do. I think it just will help the workflow as a coach to answer your questions in order to inform your decision making. Hopefully, I think that would be my wished outcome for that, or my preferred outcome. And also, just in general, I think from creating more resource, validated resource, I think that's a very important thing, because you got to still fact check on all the AI recommendations around topics. But I think if there is a better understanding of the literature and just as a researching tool, in summarizing key outcomes or even podcasts, you know, where you say, oh, I don't have the time for all the podcasts, but can you just list the most important one and I will use that. So just in general, I think it has the capacity to improve the workflow of a coach.
Yeah, no, 100% I'm with you. That's also what in my mind it would look like, hopefully not too soon, with having that help of just using natural language to get all the data you need and work with all of the data you need.
Yeah.
And not have to spend time on doing that yourself.
Exactly.
And the final question then, getting a bit more practical again, what are two things that listeners can implement that will improve their performance in endurance sports that they most likely have not thought about? So we can maybe skip the consistency and sleep more answers.
That's a hard question. That's not an easy one. I think it's just, again, trying to also, I mean, it's a bit of it should not be just a dumb answer, but just finding joy what they're doing in kind of and finding the purpose of why you're doing it is a really important one. And I would say that's not even related to any metric or to any performance outcome, but just having the clarity and vision why you still want it and why you're still chasing that and why you still dedicate so much time to it. I think that's something hopefully a lot of athletes and also coaches will be clearer or will have an ability to better understand, because sometimes I think you find yourself in this kind of wiggle room where you're not unsure if this is sustainable, if this is actually helping you, or in general if because it's a quite demanding job, not only for the athlete, also for a coach. And you know, recently we saw also a very acknowledged World Tour coach stepping out of a team just because he missed that kind of creativity and quality. It's something that needs to be taken seriously. So my hope is also that getting a better support system within the coaching versus athlete environment would be something I think would be super helpful.
That's a good note to end on for listeners. If they want to follow you, what is the best place? Is it, you're not so active on social media, I don't think.
No, that's why I stay away from the influencer. I'm not on any social media. I'm still a bit on Twitter. I still want to call it Twitter. I don't accept the X. Yeah, unfortunately, this place went really down and I'm actually not really active. I think, yeah, the best thing is listening to Scientific Triathlon, to my podcast. I'm on ResearchGate a bit. Yeah, I think that's kind of the platforms I'm available. But again, I don't.
You also did a good podcast with Joel Filial, which I can.
Oh, thank you.
As well, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's great. I really like to go on high quality podcasts like here, just because you have time to go through the deep discussions, and I find less and less joy in the fast social media world. And maybe that's why I'm getting old, or just I can't follow up with the trends. But yeah, I actually try to reduce my social media profiles nowadays.
Very understandable. All right. Well, thank you so much. It was great to catch up, and let's do it again another time soon.
Thanks, Michael. All the best. Talk to you soon. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode. Remember that you can find the detailed show notes for it on scientifictriathlon.com. If you're not aware, that's basically the blog post version of the podcast. So it's not a transcript. It's also not just bullet point list of the topics discussed. It actually contains a lot of the content in a summary format. Usually it might be 2,000 words, 3,000 words, that sort of thing. So detailed enough that you can get a lot from them, although obviously not quite as much as if you listen to the full episode. But for a lot of listeners, these are a really valuable additional resource, even just to go back and have a look at where in the episode did we discuss a particular topic, and then go and re-listening to that particular segment. We'll be back next week with another episode as usual, and I believe that we will have Jack back co-hosting, and we will discuss athlete profiling, how we as coaches adjust training based on different profiles. And this is obviously not just relevant for coaches doing athlete profiling, but if you're a self-coached athlete, you can do a profile of yourself. So it's going to be practical. It's going to be relevant for age group athletes. So stay subscribed. Subscribe if you're not already subscribed. And also remember that if YouTube is your preferred podcast consumption platform, then we are now on YouTube as well. So check that out if you prefer watching to listening. And finally, a bit of a reminder of what we do at Scientific Triathlon. We do fully individualized coaching. We do customized training plans and ready-made training plans and also consultations. So we cover a whole range of needs, wants, and budgets. And today I want to talk a little bit more about ready-made training plans, specifically a recent entry in my training plan feedback form that I got about a week ago from an Australian athlete called Bill. So Bill used the advanced sprint distance plan. And what's really impressive about Bill is that he's 70 years old. So even just to be able to do that plan, because it's an advanced plan, it's not an easy plan, that's impressive in itself. I want to read a couple of snippets from the feedback form, because I think that will give you a bit of an insight into what it might be like to work with one of our training plans. So the first one is the question, what were the greatest benefits of having a training plan? And Bill's answer here was consistency and backing off the effort on low intensity workouts. And so that's the answer. My comment here is that you could argue also that backing off the effort on low intensity workouts was the cause that led to the outcome benefit of consistency, or at least one of the factors behind it. But I mean, it's always, this is something that for most people, it might not be backing off the effort on low intensity workouts, but there's usually something, some learning that is greater than just the benefit of the structured training, something that athletes like Bill or like you can learn and then benefit from for years to come. It might be how to structure a certain type of session. It might be how to structure a week with hard and easy days. And it might be how hard or how easy to go in low intensity workouts. There are a bunch of things, even things like nutrition guidelines that we have in the plan. But yeah, anyway, there's learning beyond just the structured training. Then the second and final snippet that I want to read is, what specific results or improvement have you accomplished with the help of the plan? And the answer here was, quote, running times for 5K, got a PB, which is hard at 70 plus, end quote. So yeah, I mean, hugely impressive. I have to assume that Bill wasn't running 5Ks when he was 20 or 30 years old, because I think that that would be quite impossible to achieve a PB at 70. But even if he started at 60, to achieve a PB at 70 is incredibly impressive, even at 65, because from my experience working with athletes at that age, you're really fighting, working extremely hard just to maintain your level every year, which is, it might sound negative, but I think it can also be, you have to have the right mindset there and frame it into a positive, that even a year where you just slightly have a slight decline can be seen as a huge success. But then to get a PB, yeah, that's really fantastic work. So anyway, if you want a structured, evidence-based plan that gets results, and not just for young bucks, but across a broad age span and for both men and women, then you can find all of our ready-made plans on scientifictriathlon.com/plans and directly on the Training Peaks marketplace by searching for Scientific Triathlon. And with that, that's it for today's episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.